Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. The American diplomat Ray Naylor joined me on the podcast about a year ago to tell me about his debut novel, The Mountain Under the Sea, a philosophical thriller about the alien minds of octopuses. He's returning in this episode to talk about a new novella, The Tusks of Extinction. Tusks depicts an attempt by Russian scientists to resurrect the woolly mammoth, with subplots exploring elephant hunting for sport and for profit. It's very much a thematic companion piece to the earlier novel, so as they say, if you like that, you'll love this one. I certainly did. Here's my conversation with Ray. Ray Naylor, welcome back to the How To Academy podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
Last year, we talked about your debut novel, The Mountain Under the Sea. And at the end of the podcast, you said you had another long work ready. And here we are talking about it, The Tusks of Extinction. I don't know what your elevator pitch for the book is. Mine is, it's Jurassic Park, but with mammoths and ideas. How would you describe it?
That's quite, I like your pitch. That's awesome. I would say that it is an ice core of my thinking about embodiment and how it affects the way we see the world. That's one thing. And then it's kind of my reaction to the time I spent working on elephant ivory trafficking in Vietnam and how that gets worked through a science fiction writer's mind. But I think your pitch is much better than mine. I can never come up with like a clean way to describe my work in two or three sentences, and I feel like I need to just sit down sometime.
Yeah, just drop me an email next time and I'll come up with something. I can't do the writing of the story, but I'm good at selling, Ray.
I like yours because usually people just take two sometimes seemingly random books and say, oh, it's like this and this put together, which I kind of is a trend I'm not a big fan of.
I think it's an industry formula that's recognized, though, isn't it? If it's a little, yeah. Even if a little trite. Catch us up on your life since last year. You told us last year that you often move faster than your bio, and you are a globe-trotting diplomat, as I'm sure regular listeners will remember. So where are you now?
I am still in Washington, D.C. I took another job. I took a job now as a diplomat in residence, visiting scholar at the George Washington University in their Institute of International Science and Technology Policy. So I'm still here this time. So I didn't too much outrun my bio. And then my plan is to actually stay here for a while, maybe grow a few sort of roots. We'll see.
Well, when we're doing the interview for next year's book, you can let me know how that's going.
Yeah, exactly.
As an American diplomat, you specialize in Russia. You speak Russian. You've lived and worked in Moscow, and you must have some good stories about that. Can you give us a sense of what your life in Moscow was like? The relevance being that Tusks is set in Russia, and the protagonist is Russian. And one would have thought that you're drawing on that experience a bit here, indirectly.
Yeah, so I haven't much worked on Russia as a diplomat, and my time in Moscow was well before my time with the Foreign Service. I lived there from 2007 and 2008, and then before that in 2005. So I lived there twice in Moscow, but not just in Moscow. I got to travel pretty much all over the country, which was great. Got to see what the rest of Russia was like, which is very different from what life is like in Moscow. And yeah, this book is drawing, of course, heavily from that experience. Also from the experience of traveling in Siberia, which is, my wife is from Tomsk, which is a Siberian city. And so we spent some time exploring that area as well. So I have that kind of firmly in my brain. And as a speaker of Russian, of course, that gets, you know, daily practice still, I think a lot of that informs this book. I sort of say that, you know, at some point, I suppose I'll have also written through all of my childhood obsessions, Of which like polar exploration and mammoths are one. The octopus was another. And then I'll probably run out of novel ideas. But so far, they take long enough to write out that that hasn't happened yet. So yeah, this is, I mean, just the I still can sort of time travel back to that time in Moscow and get that feeling of being in Russia anytime I want to. And so I also wanted to make sure I'm writing all of these books while those things are still fresh.
What took you then to Russia originally, if not diplomatic duty?
So I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Turkmenistan, and it's kind of a funny story. I'm originally in Turkmen when I came there in my Peace Corps training. And then when I actually got to my work site, everyone that I worked with said, "Oh, you speak Turkmen. That's really cute." We all speak Russian because none of us are actually Turkmen. And they were mostly from Azerbaijan or Armenia and had been living in Turkmenistan for a long time. But, they were part of this mobile sort of post-Soviet intelligentsia. And so they said, "Well, it's time to teach you Russian." So, they did. And over the next couple of years, I got decent, at least in Russian. And then I decided I wanted to stay overseas. So I took a job recruiting for a company called American Councils for International Education, basically going around Russia interviewing high school students for an exchange program where they would spend a year in the US.
Can you unpack some of the myths about life in Russia and even Russian people that we have in the West? What did you find your experience of Russian culture was like compared to American culture?
Yeah, it's interesting to, I kind of go back and forth about trying to do things like this, like trying to help people better understand Russian culture. Because in the end, I think sort of like the longer you live in a place and the more you live with people from that place, the more your sense of that, you kind of pass through these phases. Let's say initially you're like, "I understand this place and I could tell other people, what it's like." And then you sort of get to, "I know so many people from here that I no longer understand anything about this place. And in fact, it just seems like anywhere else, like kind of a confusing mass of different ways of thinking about the world, et cetera." But, in general, what I would say is I have a lot of good friends from that region, from Russia and from Central Asia, where I spent a lot of time from the sort of former Soviet republics. And they, like most people in the world, I think, are a little bit difficult to get to know at first. And then once you become their friend, you sort of have that friendship for the rest of your life. And it's something that, as long as you do your part in nurturing it, you'll always have. One of the problems that I think I find with Americans is that we're somewhat the opposite. Someone I was recently talked to said Americans are like peaches, like initially really kind of soft and welcoming, and they seem so friendly, and then you get to this hard core in them that you just can't get beyond. And it's quite surprising. Russians are a little bit more like, let's say, I don't know, an egg, right? You once you crack through that shell, the inside is quite soft, and you find that they're sort of the opposite. You once you get to know them, they're very forthcoming, and friendship is less transactional than it can be here in the US. I won't speak for the whole West. I'll stick to my own knowledge, but less transactional and less based around just liking some mutual activity. It's like, "Oh, we're friends because we play on the same football team," or "we go climbing together," or something. And as soon as you stop climbing or playing football, that person kind of goes poof and disappears. So there's that. And then I think it's, the other thing is, I mean, it's quite clear that it's a country that's been very unfortunate in its history. And I think that, its people do carry a sense with them of this kind of tragedy of Russian political life and what has happened to them. And sometimes it seems to them, and it seems to outsiders probably too, like almost like a bad joke. Like it's like every time they have some moment of reform, like in 1917 when it seemed like the Tsar was going to be replaced by democracy, right? And then Lenin comes along and crushes that idea, right? destroys the Russian Duma, drives democracy out of Russia for decades afterwards. It just seems like every time they have a chance to raise their head up, something happens. And it's quite often, it's easy to blame it on some sort of cyclical, intrinsic thing in their culture. But sometimes it also just seems like what they would call like a black swan event, you know, like the appearance of some particular person who just comes, brings it all crashing down.
I mean, this novel set a couple of hundred years in the future and things still aren't going well.
Right.
Are you worried about receiving public censure for depicting Russian culture too romantically?
Well, I don't think I depict it romantically. No, I'm not. I'm not worried about that kind of censure. I'm not at all. I think I just, if anything, depict everyone that I write about consistently as real people with real complications and real concerns. You know, people say, how do you write about cultures that are different from your own? And what I tell them is, with a massive amount of research, personal knowledge, and respect for other human beings, there's not a single person on earth who truly has a culture that is like your own, since we're all these sort of constellations, and increasingly so, right, of difference and realized difference as the world sort of frees up a little bit. Every unique person on this earth is hard to write, and that's the way that it ought to be. So, you know, this is a place that I know well, but that doesn't mean that I just start out to, you know, with some sort of confidence. I think you start out from a place of feeling like you have a lot more to learn. And, you know, I would point out too that the main character is not a Russian. The main character is a Tatar. And, you know, one of the things that I also wanted to kind of point out is that this is a very big, diverse country with a lot of people in it, and the titular ethnicity are not the only people living in that space. And there's certainly a lot more going on that the West is pretty ignorant of. I mean, we have, you know, have a long history of referring to everyone who comes from this enormous space, and even the Soviet space, as Russian, right? When there were so many different people there.
Tusks is an entertainment. It's a high concept thriller. But there is real anger coming through, and that is your disgust towards poaching and the ivory trade. You mentioned earlier this coming to your attention in Vietnam. Can you tell us a bit more about that and what you learned about the ivory trade in your research for this book?
Yeah, so while I was working in Vietnam as the environment, science, technology, and health officer down at the consulate in Ho Chi Minh City, we encountered the ivory trade quite a bit. And so Vietnam is one of the through trafficking countries for elephant ivory, also a destination country. And one of the things that was happening while I was in Vietnam was that the ivory price had gone up so much that it had become profitable, actually, to send someone to go on a big game hunting expedition and legally hunt elephants. The cost of that expedition would be less than the ivory you could get back if you could manage to, you know, evade some of the really, to be honest, weak restrictions around the trading in ivory that you've taken off an elephant that you've killed in one of these big game expeditions. So something that was happening in Vietnam that was fascinating was that they were using sex workers to go to Africa, to Africa on big game expeditions, several different countries in Africa, and hunt elephants and then bring the ivory back to Vietnam, which was an amazing sort of linkage of traffickings, right? So you had quite often a trafficked person being then sent in the guise of some kind of hunter, and it was often really patently ridiculous, to this place where they were basically just given a gun, helped to point it at this elephant, killed the elephant. Then they have like a picture of this poor, you know, sex worker standing with this elephant that they've killed. Then they would bring the trophy back to Vietnam, where it would be then sent on into this network of ivory trafficking. So it was like the full circle of, all of this human exploitation tied up with the destruction of these magnificent animals for this virtually worthless, substance, which had been just driven up in value by a market that made absolutely no sense. I mean, it has so many, there were so many tragic ways in which it was linked to our whole way of looking at each other and at the world. And it stuck with me for a really long time, but I didn't exactly know where to put it. And I think when it really started to click was when also elephant ivory became so valuable that people started hunting for mammoth tusks in the Arctic. And that mammoth tusk trade, interestingly enough, started reinvigorating the illegal elephant ivory trade because it was very difficult to tell mammoth tusks from elephant tusks. You could just say that your elephant tusk was indeed a mammoth tusk. And so again, you had these sort of cycles, this like weird feedback loops between all of this bizarre, exploitative activity. And the tusk hunters in the far north were some of the most desperate people as well. Of course, this is, this is a dangerous and laborious, activity, basically using fire hoses to blow mud quite often away from riverbanks and then, create these caves and pull these bones out of them. And those caves collapse on people all the time. I mean, it was really this, again, this kind of just cycle of poverty and violence and exploitation mixed up with people's weird desires to have this pointless commodity, right?
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Well, we're going to talk about the fact that in your book, the mammoths fight back in a minute. But I first wanted to ask how you strike a balance as the author of a work of fiction between political agitation and the need to tell a gripping story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of started with The Mountain and the Sea. Someone said, oh, I don't think it's really possible to write a book that's both gripping and readable and has any sort of real philosophical content. And I kind of said, well, I don't think that it's correct. I think it can be done. I think that a book can have a commitment to really deep ideas, but then at the same time be, done in such a way that it holds people's interest and is entertaining. And I, in fact, I feel like that's the history of the novel in many ways, that the novel has always been really engaged with the idea at its core. I mean, let's go look at Heart of Darkness, right? Which is like a really gripping depiction of this travel upriver, right? And then also is deeply invested in human concerns. And I think, I would actually say that in general, Joseph Conrad would be a good model for that. He does write these gripping thrillers like The Secret Sharer and all of these, books that are, that I would say, you would call thrillers. Of course, their language is very different, but they're also, deeply engaged in politics, philosophy, et cetera. What I would, I guess my counter question is, and maybe you can answer this. I don't know, but probably you can. Why is there this insistence that fiction be, and especially genre fiction, be disengaged from our modern concerns?
I would say, as a genre fiction snob, that perhaps it's literary fiction which has been stripped of philosophical content. And genre fiction has, at least to an extent, continued the tradition of the novel of ideas, which is also entertaining. And your work maybe exemplifies that. But I am a genre snob. So I don't want to speak for the whole of the literati. Let's talk about elephants and mammoths. Everyone knows that an elephant never forgets, but your depiction of elephant memory is different to the eidetic memory you dramatized in Mountain Under the Sea, because it's sensory. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I was doing research on elephants for the book. I have this kind of, I have the, you have an idea and an interest, and I'm always kind of scouting around for new, interesting ways of looking at the world, which I think is sort of the key to for me to an interesting book is finding some angle in to the world, something people haven't thought about too much before or hasn't been overthought. And while I was doing the research on elephants, I discovered that they, quite often use this organ in their mouth to sort of taste the world, and it appears to lead directly to their like memory center. So the observation was that elephants will, when they come upon the dung of another elephant, quite often taste it and then stand there. They'll sort of touch it, they'll put it in their trunk into the roof of their mouth, and then they'll stand there sort of clearly filtering information, right? Remembering something, making some sort of like sound, swaying back and forth and kind of thinking. And then they will either quite often go and fo try to follow that elephant or turn and go in another direction based on previous encounters. And I thought that's it's a really fascinating idea. We all, of course, have these sort of stereotyped ideas about elephants as having these perfect memories. And I think that those ideas come from human knowledge, probably even pre, say, scientific knowledge of elephants. I mean, I think one thing that's really worth remembering about elephants is that Europeans, 1,000 years ago, or let's say more like 2,000 years ago, probably would have had a lot more contact with elephants in a lot different in different situations than they do now. So you wouldn't have seen them, of course, in zoos, which is the only place that we really encounter them, but you would have seen them in armies, right? In many places in Europe. And you would have seen them as both an animal and an animal that carries a sense of sort of this, I always put this word very much in quotes, like some exotic kind of animal, but also an instrument of warfare, right? Like literally like the juggernaut, right? This instrument used by the Romans and used by other armies, or the prize of a sultan, right? But these were animals that people kind of had access to and lived whole lives around and had to know about. So we have a pretty good sense, I think, of elephants as humans. And I thought exploring that connection kind of brought me back to human memory and its connection to smell and sort of sensory memories. And since what I'm, one of the things that I'm constructing in the book is kind of a hybrid, right? It allowed me a way to talk about human memory as well and how it shapes us as people.
Let's just explain that for listeners. For context, the heroine of the novel has her mind uploaded into a cloned mammoth body. And she's given the task of teaching cloned mammoths how to be mammoths because they don't have the natural evolved sense of what they should do as organisms in their native environment. They're sort of zoo-trained animals. Can you tell us what the relationship is between a mammoth and a modern-day elephant?
I think that what people misunderstand about de-extinction, to kind of back this up, is that you can't bring anything back. what you can do is assemble something that is new that has some of the genetic traits of something that existed before. So first of all, the formation of a species isn't all because of its DNA. Some of it is because of what happens during gestation in the womb. And there's this really complex, you know, interactive building process that goes into making an individual in any species. So unless you have access to an artificial womb of some kind, which we don't, and which I don't think that we would even in a few hundred years, you're going to have a mother that is not the same as the animal that you're trying to bring back, which raises all kinds of challenges, but also means that, you know, it, fundamentally, if you bring back really, again, in sort of scare quotes, right? You bring back the mammoth. You're not doing that. You're bringing back some kind of a hybrid that has mammoth-like things about it. But it's also the part that people forget about animals quite often is that, you know, a lot of their behaviors are not instinctual. They're learned. And especially with animals that live quite a long time and that actually have a relationship with their parents, the ways that the elephants do with a wider sort of family group, they learn a lot from the other members of their group, and especially from the generations that have come before. So a mammoth wouldn't know what it was to be a mammoth. That's not something that they could know. You're kind of, imagine taking a person and just bringing them into a world in which no other people exist, and then expecting them to know what it's like to be a human being. Well, they wouldn't know the first thing about it. And an elephant wouldn't know what it was like really to be an elephant if you separated it from its parents and brought it up in a different context. So she is kind of placed to help mammoths understand how to be mammoths, right? One of the great things about human beings is that we can learn things and retain them in ways that that other species, because they don't have access to symbolic language and writing and things like that, cannot. So once their oral, let's say, just call, you know, oral tradition, right? Their passed down tradition, their physical traditions, their here and now very present culture is broken, there's no way for it to be recovered. And what Damira, the protagonist, is doing is trying to help the mammoth recover these new sort of hybrid beings, like these chimeras, right? Recover a sense of what it would be to be a mammoth so that they can thrive.
We know you're a diplomat and not a scientist, but how would one resurrect a mammoth?
Well, what you would need to do is you would need to piece together all of the available DNA that you would gain from mammoth corpses that you pulled out of the ice. You would need to fill in the gaps of that DNA with something similar, probably with elephant DNA, something like that, something you had access to that wasn't damaged, because DNA is damaged quite easily. And so it's not like you're going to be able to draw a complete DNA sequence out of the ice. So then you would fill in the gaps. And, you know, Michael Crichton was pretty good about this, right? Like with the dinosaurs, they fill in the gaps with frog DNA, and that allows the dinosaurs to change their genders, which sounds like a little bit of a cheap trick until you realize that just recently we witnessed a Komodo dragon change its gender when it appeared on an island alone and become a female who then laid an egg, right? And fertilized herself and laid an egg to make more Komodo dragons. So we know, or not Komodo dragon, it was an iguana of something. I'm forgetting exactly what the species was, but lizards can do this. Fish can do this. Many species can do this. Anyway, getting back to how you make a mammoth. So you fill in the DNA with probably elephant DNA, probably modern elephants. And then you have to create a viable fetus and gestate that in an elephant. And that's where you're gonna put it, basically, is in an elephant. And then that elephant gives birth to this chimera, you know, this sort of half elephant, half mammoth, which hopefully has enough mammoth to make it seem or be able to behave in the way that a mammoth does. And then you would have to figure out a way to get that mammoth to survive in an alien environment that was very alien from it.
And that is where the novel picks up. Why would one want to resurrect a mammoth?
Yeah, this I think is a great question. And I think it's kind of one of the questions that the the book sort of addresses in an oblique way, because I don't have a great answer to this question. I guess my question always is, okay, why not focus energy on saving what we have? Why not use all of this science to bring back from the brink of extinction, or bring back from recent extinction, animals that still have a niche on Earth? One of the problems with the mammoth, right? Bringing back the mammoth, is that there are all these other animals that are missing, that the mammoth were a part of the mammoth's world. What about the woolly rhinoceros? What about the giant sloth? What about, all of these? What about the cave bears and, the saber-toothed tiger and all of these other ice age, animals? Are you gonna bring back the ice age, right? And along with the mammoth, there's some arguments that the mammoth would help with climate change, by sort of extending snow coverage, that it would, there's a lot of arguments for it. I don't think any of them are entirely convincing. I think the reason that you bring the mammoth back is the same reason that human beings do anything. And I think this is in it's in The Mountain and the Sea, so I'm sort of paraphrasing one of, myself. Like, the great and terrible thing about human beings is that we will always do what we're capable of, right? And it can be quite a horrifying, with horrifying results sometimes. But there's no stopping, in many ways, people from doing these kinds of things.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
On which note, tech billionaires are everywhere in science fiction at the moment, and they are rarely the heroes, including in Tusks.
Yeah, so there is, in Tusks, this legal hunting expedition going on, and one of the things that I was sort of fascinated, I'm sort of fascinated by, as, and especially, like, I gotta say, like, as a man, I'm really fascinated by men who think that going and killing an animal, usually a very rare one or a very difficult to get to one, is just the most masculine thing that you could possibly do. It's a kind of masculinity that I just completely, I find totally alien to me and completely disagree with. It seems to be the opposite to me of masculinity in a way. Like,
Wait, Ray, are you suggesting that you've never shot any animal?
I
Never shot an elephant?
no.
Shockingly.
I actually had to, and it was really some of the most disturbing research I had to do was to actually research how to shoot an elephant, because that's one of the things that happens, in the book, is you have someone being sort of told how to kill an elephant correctly. So I had to go to, like, the websites of these big game hunters and read through, like, how you kill an elephant. Yeah, I'm fascinated by that kind of weird, abstracted violence. And I remember very distinctly listening to a conversation, all these big game hunters who were going after the Marco Polo sheep in Kyrgyzstan when I was living in Kyrgyzstan, and thinking, man, you've come a long way just to destroy something so wonderful, right? It's just such an odd thing. Like, you've spent tens of thousands of dollars and gone through so much effort to kill this animal that all you had to do, to leave it alone, was not spend tens of thousands of dollars and come here and kill it. It's just such a bizarre thing.
Do you understand it? I mean, you've intellectualized it, and in the novel, one of the characters understands the appeal, quote unquote, of killing mammoths on an intellectual level, but not on a phenomenological level. Do you understand it on that level? I don't. And I realized reading Tusks that I didn't, and I was asking my best friend about it while reading the book, and he had no real emotional grasp on the appeal. And would you say that was something that you got to grips with over writing the novel, or something that you continue to struggle with?
No, I don't understand it. I don't. But not understanding something doesn't stop you from being able to represent it, right? Like I don't understand it, but I can go and find things written by people who understand it and incorporate that into my research. It's kind of similar to like, I don't understand how an octopus's brain works exactly, but I could read a lot about it and I can study it and I can represent this alien thing on the page, I think, pretty well. But I would say this is like harder than trying to represent an octopus's mind in many ways, because it's not 1930 anymore, right? Like we're not Hemingway thinking these things are glorious and living in a culture where you know these things are thought of as glorious. We live in a completely different space and we look at the environment and know things about the environment that they just never could have known. And I think a lot of people found their behavior repulsive back then, but much more so now. So no, I totally don't. I don't. I do think there's something masochistic in a sense about it, and that's what I kind of tried to bring out. Like there's something self-destructive in killing something beautiful, and there's something that just strips away the meaning of existence. And so that's why I sort of linger on some of those moments in the character who's doing this, you know, in the way that it is a kind of, I think there's just a kind of self-hatred. I think you really do see it in Hemingway, for example. There is a self-loathing there in some of the short stories about big game hunting that really comes out. This sense of pointlessness and just horror at it.
And then there's a sense of delusion, I think, in a lot of hunting literature that the animal is equally dangerous to you.
Yes.
The man with the gun.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and I think this is in the character of Sviatoslav, who's the poacher's, you know, son. That's what he basically says, like that killing animals is easy. Like you have this gun and you just go and you learn how to shoot, and that's not hard to learn either. And then you go and kill them because you have this technology that they don't. And you know, how is there any glory or interest attached to doing this thing? It would be, you know, if you killed them maybe with your bare hands, I guess, like then that would be some kind of macho, you know, accomplishment. But again, you're still back to like, why?
Yeah. Your tech billionaire has his own special gun as well. He won't even use a normal gun. He wants to use his bespoke tech billionaire gun, which is the best gun.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. To make it even easier. Oh my God. If only I had my special gun.
Yes, I can clearly imagine this in my head, you know, like the tech billionaire with his special gun that he's done all his research on and you know had made for him and all of this stuff. Yeah, I mean you can't relate to everyone, right? And there's plenty of people on earth that I just can't. That's the difficulty of communication, and that's sort of, we may have talked about this a little bit when we're talking about The Mountain and the Sea. That's what I've always found unconvincing about these ideas that we could speak to another species, is that we can't half the time, maybe more than half the time, even communicate effectively with one another. And so what kind of hubris leads us to believe that we'd be able to speak to anyone else, right?
I want to talk about another dimension of the tech billionaire going on a mammoth hunt plotline, which is the moral quandary of accepting money from the rich and powerful in order to finance something you believe is scientifically worthwhile or a necessity politically or for some other reason, something that you believe is good. How do you, Ray Naylor, the diplomat who has seen much of the world and thought about this a lot, think about those kinds of quandaries? Have you seen them in your professional life, or is this something you're just imagining as a thought experiment for this one work of literature?
Oh no, I think it's something woven through all of our lives, right? So as an academic, you probably work at an institution that's embedded in this system. In any profession, right, we're kind of woven into exploitative systems and trying to make the best of them. I think some of the most fascinating characters for me, and this was certainly true of Ha from The Mountain and the Sea, and it's true of Damira, and true of most of the characters I write, is I try to write from that sense of people entangled in systems that they don't necessarily agree with. And in the new book that I'm writing right now, I mean, there's a character that basically, his only opposition to the system that he's involved in is just not sharing its goals, right? Like that's the only opposition he can allow himself, is simply not to want the things that it wants. I mean, I think we're all, and it's hard to admit how entangled we are in these things, but we're all there. And so this is maybe just a more extreme way of asking that question. I don't have an answer to that question. I'm tangled up in systems that I don't agree with. I'm tangled up in all sorts of exploitative environments. I mean, the city, just the urban space, right, is a system of inequalities, and it rewards certain kinds of living and punishes other people for their backgrounds, their race, their desires, their whatever. And you can name any sort of difference, right? And it's a punishable difference in many ways. So I think it's kind of a way of it, of my own self meditation on compromise. Like, we have to at some point admit that we are within systems that don't allow us to be as good as we might want to be, if that's what we're looking for. I mean, if you were gonna talk about the Buddhist path, right, it would be like right employment, right, right work. It's a difficulty I think everyone faces, and I really, I don't mean to point out academia in particular, but it's a really good example of the ways in which extremely progressive people, right, are tangled up in systems and in institutions that are often damaging in other ways, right? Even to knowledge production.
I mean, before you worked in academia, you worked for the American government, so.
So I mean, like you don't agree with everything that your system does, but I guess my only sense for myself is that you carve out a place in which you feel that you are doing good, and that you are contributing somehow to some kind of overall benefit, right? And you try to look at the very nuanced balances in that, right? Am I able to help people? Am I able to be of use, in a good way in this world? It's hard. It's hard.
Well, Ray, you've alluded to it already, but dare I ask, what's next for you writing-wise? Are we going to see you again this time next year?
Yes, I think you're going to see me again next year. So I am finishing up the next book, and well, finishing up meaning like I've already sold it. It's getting scheduled. I'm just doing the obligatory, rewrites and nudging things around and polishing. That's part of that. And then I've already got the next idea as well. So I'm just pushing forward. That's all
Wow,
I can.
you're way ahead.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've got three ideas, and I had to decide which one is maybe next. It's kind of like this, the TBR pile. The newest idea somehow always ends up on top, and the other ones sort of sink down, and then you're like, oh, well, maybe not. And you try to rewrite, sort of like rearrange your stack of books or whatever. But yeah, I am probably at least two or three ideas ahead of myself in novel writing right now.
And they're all childhood obsessions coming back to life.
Yeah, kind of to some extent, they're kind of all childhood obsessions. I mean, I don't think I understood that phrase, the child is the father of the man, until I really started writing and realizing that I've just been thinking about these things ever since I was a little kid. Like the seeds were all there, and I probably formed some portion of that, although I was very different from how I am now. That there's still this common thread, and that's a bit of a mystery to me, how I am still linked back to these kind of things. That
I think all writing is autobiographical to an extent, even technical to an extent.
Absolutely. And you were talking about like sort of the books, The Mountain and the Sea and Tusks of Extinction, being kind of linked to one another in a way, thematically. And might have been talking about this before we started, but I think that's really true. And I think that's true because they're both like they're close to each other in the core sample, right? Of like these are my interests, and when I finished The Mountain and the Sea, I still had a lot of interests in these things, and that's where my focus was, and so the next book was kind of going to be there. And then as my interests drift over time, the books will also change, their interests, but there's certain things that I always am going to come back to, and I'm perfectly aware of that, I'm never going to stop being interested in memory and its formative properties for individuals. I'm never going to be stop being interested in how we're tangled up in systems and how you incorporate ideas of any sort of human freedom for motion in that tangle. Because I refuse to believe in free will. At the same time, I completely refuse to believe in like a zero level of choice, right? And so the way that those two refusals play out is really important for me. And I think it always will be in my characters, right? There's no point at which someone has zero choice, but there is a point at which one might want to ask oneself, as a society especially, is individual justice making sense, right? Given how little choice some people end up having due to what's been, put before them, done to them, et cetera,
Well,
right?
if our listeners are interested in exploring that theme more, I would like to draw their attention to our debate between Daniel Dennett and Robert Sapolsky a couple of weeks ago on free will determinism and social justice. You can also listen to it, Ray. You might
Ah,
enjoy
perfect. Yeah,
it.
I've listened to a bunch of those, and yeah, I, as usual, I find myself going like, it's neither, it's neither.
It's neither. Yeah, my position as well. Well, we'll find out more about your next novel this time next year. But Ray Naylor, thank you very much for coming back on the How To Academy podcast.
Thank you for having me again. It's been great.
This episode of the podcast starred Ray Naylor and was produced and presented by me, Vas Christodoulou. I make the show with Nicole Wong and our editor, John Doughty. Next up, we've got Daniel Goleman on emotional intelligence and another acclaimed author of speculative fiction, Kelly Link. Till then, thanks for listening.